All right, Genesis chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him an overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in this house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her, to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. So it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought in to us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened, when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to mock me. So it happened, as I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside." So it was, when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Let's stand and we'll pray.
Okay, last time, if you were with us a few months ago, Pastor Jonah began a series on the life of Joseph. He was in Genesis chapter 37, where Joseph's story started, with a message titled, "The Death of Dreams." In that message, we saw the beginning of Joseph's life. Right? He was 17 years old, one of the youngest, in fact, the second youngest of Jacob's sons. And Jacob loved Joseph more than all the other boys. And he gave him a multicolored or long-sleeved coat as a symbol of this love, which only caused his brothers to hate him more. All right? He had 11 brothers, and they had jealousy and envy toward this man Joseph, this young man, 17 years old. To make matters worse, he had a few dreams in this chapter. If you recall, One of the dreams symbolized his 11 brothers bowing down and worshiping him. And the other dream, it not only involved his brothers bowing down and worshiping him, but even his mother and father. You can imagine how that went over at the dinner table. 17-year-old boy with 10 older brothers. Well, still Jacob's favorite, he sent him to check up on his brothers. And when they saw him coming from a ways off, their first thought is, let's kill him. Let's kill him. Then they perhaps thought a little deeper and they consented, let's just sell him. Let's not kill him, let's sell him to Ishmaelite traders. And so that's what they did. And afterward they convinced their father he was killed by an animal. And Jacob mourned for years. So today we're picking up this series in the life of Joseph, and now we find him in Egypt. Joseph had been purchased as a slave by Potiphar. And time again, we're going to see this man Joseph in a difficult situation. When it appears that things are about to turn around and go good, turn for the better, he's once again thrown into a season of trial and testing. Do you ever feel like you just can't catch a break? Or wonder why, when you do the right thing, bad things happen? But as believers, it is in these times of trial and testing that our character can be refined and God's faithfulness can shine. So that's what we're going to look at in part two of our series on the life of Joseph. I've titled this Overcoming Temptation. Turn to chapter 39 if you're not already there, and we'll begin. And first, we have the setup. Okay? Verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. And so Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had put under his authority, all that he had, he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And ending verse 6, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So, Joseph's been taken to Egypt, right? He's young, maybe 17 to 20 at this time, somewhere in that range. He was taken to a land, Egypt, which in the Bible is the epicenter of the world and everything the world had to offer. 17 to 20 years old. He's a slave, he's vulnerable, under the control and influence of others. He's a long way from home and everything he knew. And he's without any family or relatives or childhood friends. And then we read, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. I don't think you need to read this to know where this is going. All right, question. Where do you think a story like this goes? You got a young man in his prime, good looking and well built. suddenly transplanted to the epicenter of worldly culture. In a position of vulnerability with absolutely no accountability. You know what that sounds like? A freshman at UW Stout. I've been there. Not the good looking part, but I've been there. A freshman at UW Stout. All right, Joseph did have something going for him, though. And we read that here as well. He did have something going for him. In verse 2, we read, the Lord was with Joseph. Okay, and again, in verse 3, the Lord was with him. See, the Psalms tell us that God is our refuge and his strength, a very present help in trouble. So what do we do? And maybe you're there. What do we do when we're lost in a worldly culture? Surrounded by ungodliness. Where do we turn when we feel isolated? Just all alone. Perhaps in our dorm room. I remember coming to UW Stout feeling that way. No accountability. Party time, right? No accountability. Parents are gone. Friends that maybe or maybe did not hold me accountable, gone. My brothers and sisters, definitely gone. Surrounded by ungodliness. In fact, the pinnacle, in my mind, of worldliness. I did have a worn-out Bible that I developed a habit to read nightly. And so I did. Sometimes all alone, in despair, sometimes even in defeat. The Bible tells us, draw near, right? Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. And that the Lord is near to all those who call upon him. Sometimes that's all we got. That's all we got is God. Are we seeking God's presence in these circumstances? It's been said by one theologian that I was studying from. He said, implicit in this account is the idea that God's presence with Joseph is linked to Joseph's commitment to the Lord. How committed are we to seeking the Lord this morning? We also read that his master saw that the Lord was with him. So this was visible even to his worldly master. So Joseph, we see, was successful. And the Lord made all that he did to prosper. And the master made him overseer all over everything. And the blessing of the Lord was on all in the house and in the field. So his master sees this. But as we know, his master isn't the only one who notices Joseph in this story. And that takes us from the setup to the temptation. Let's go to verse 7. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. And he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I. Nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So it was, in verse 10, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. we read his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." Now, as I heard one person state before this, we have no idea how old she was or what she looked like. So I think that's one aspect we have to realize here. However, it's safe to say that this temptation was very real and very strong. Why do I say that? Well, she was a person of high standing and of power. It would be in the interest of Joseph to oblige his master's wife. He'd be seen favorable, at least in her sight. Furthermore, being the wife of an official of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, it's probably pretty safe to say that he had his choice of who he was going to marry. It's probably safe to say that she was attractive, perhaps even young. We know she could afford the finest in Egyptian apparel to seduce with. He, 17 to 20 years old, any guy in here would say it doesn't take much at that age. You're in your prime sexually. Your drive is at its peak. And he's away from home with nobody to warn him, nobody to stop him. It's safe to say that this was a very real and very strong temptation for Joseph. Perhaps even the other guys in the house, seeing what's going on, were egging him on. Go for it, man. Nobody's there to say no. Have you been there, faced with a strong, relentless temptation? I've been there. I think you have too. I remember rented this room in Kellogg, Minnesota, between here and Rochester, Minnesota, when I worked at IBM. In the basement, renting a room all by myself away from everybody, of a lady who taught yoga at the local schools. And I remember going to sleep some nights, fighting temptation so hard in my head that I fell asleep with a headache. It was just so insane. I think a lot of people know what this is like, to be tempted and for it to be ongoing. You know, she spoke to him, it says, day by day, to lie with her, to be with her. This was not a one-time thing. This is constant, relentless invitation to sin. How would Joseph overcome it? We see here, he acknowledges a few things. He realizes all his master had given him, and he realizes the position he'd been put in. But I really think the key here isn't necessarily that. I think the key was his question at the end. He says, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Against God. You know, I think a lot of us would admit this is a sin against the wife, this is a sin against Potiphar, the husband. But that wasn't Joseph's primary concern here. His primary concern was sinning against God. It wasn't what was immediately in front of him. It was what was here in the heavens and with him in presence. How could I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Do we see, when we sin, do we see our sin as great wickedness against God? Evil. There's a book. If you have a problem with this, I highly recommend a thick book written by Jeremiah Burroughs in like the late 1600s. It'll convince you. It's called Evil of Evils, The Exceeding Sinfulness of Sin. And in it, he paints this picture at the introduction of the book. It's a thick book all about how bad sin is. And he paints this giant picture in the beginning of the book of these demons just screaming in a lake of fire and reaching up and screeching out, and their bodies being consumed, but they cannot die, and just continual agony. And he says, the least sin that you commit is more evil than that for all eternity. And his argument in the entire book is how sin is so much more evil than suffering. Jeremiah Burroughs, Puritan writer from the late 1600s. The psalmist cried out, against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil, evil in your sight. But what motivated Joseph here to overcome when others had failed? There's few characters like Joseph in the Bible. I think Jonah alluded to this last time. I mean, I'm looking through the Bible in the Old Testament, and you find maybe Joshua, maybe Daniel, have such integrity and character before God like this Joseph. But those guys, if you read their accounts, they were visited by angels. They literally heard the voice of God, and they experienced crazy miracles. You know, Daniel in the lion's den, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire. Daniel's there watching these guys not get consumed by a fire. He gets to see God's handwriting on a wall. Or Joshua, I mean, the Jordan River stops and they all walk across in dry ground. Then the walls of Jericho fall to the ground. Miracles upon miracles. And then after that, you've got, beyond that miracle, you've got him fighting against the Canaanites. And the sun stands still so he can end the fight. The sun stops for Joshua. Unbelievable miracles that these guys experience. But Joseph, he'll never see an angel. He'll never hear the voice of God, not audibly. And he doesn't witness any obvious miracles. So what causes this guy Joseph to have this kind of character? All he had to go on at this point, keep in mind, is a couple big Bible stories. You know, God, big God creates the sun, the moon, the stars, the earth, the plants, the animals, us. He's got that in his background. One other story he's got is a big God destroys everything he created with a catastrophic worldwide flood. That's the Sunday school lessons up to this point. So Joseph does not have a lot to go on here. What motivated him to overcome such strong, relentless temptation? Paged through a number of commentaries and study Bibles, came to this quote. It says, this is what is known throughout Scripture as the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord. Joseph was in constant awareness of the there-ness of God, an awareness equally convicting and comforting, end quote. The fear of God. I know a lot of us bristle when we hear that. The fear of God. Commentator goes on to say, he was severed from his country and his family, but Joseph knew he was never alone. He carried with him the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord? It's intrigued me. So I did some searching. There's 20 chapters, by the way. There's breaks, there's other stories in between, but about 20 chapters in Genesis. Genesis 30 to 50, where we have Joseph mentioned. His birth in 30 and his death in 50. Along with a few other passages that talk about him. If you go through all that and you look, you'll nowhere read that Joseph loved God. I'm not saying he didn't. I'm just saying you won't read that he loved God. Nor will you read that Joseph trusted God. You don't even read that Joseph ever worshipped God. Again, I'm not saying he didn't do these things. You just don't have any account of it. Nor do you read that Joseph built an altar, made a sacrifice, received promises from God, and then worshiped God, like happened with his father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You don't read that about Joseph, ever. But in one verse, in the midst of 20 chapters, Joseph explicitly defines his relationship with God. Chapter 42, verse 18, Joseph says, "I fear God. I fear God." Joseph was motivated by the fear of God. What does that even mean, to fear God? Some would say it means to be in awe of, to have respect for, to revere. True, but the Hebrew word yare also means to be afraid, to be frightened, to be cautious, to be dismayed, to be fearful, and to be terrified. I think Matt Chandler was teaching on this at the couples retreat last week. He used the word dread in Malachi. Our modern culture likes to emphasize, and our modern church culture likes to emphasize the love of God. But in doing so, we can neglect the importance of the fear of God. The fear of God. What does the Bible say to us about this fear of God? Let me give you a few passages. Deuteronomy 6:13. "It is the Lord your God you shall fear, and him you shall serve." Joshua 24:14. "Fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness." Jeremiah 32:40 says, "I will put my fear in their hearts, that they shall not depart from me." Malachi 1:6, "If I am a master, where is my fear? Says the Lord of hosts." And Malachi 1:14, "For I am a great king, says the Lord of hosts, and my name will be feared among the nations." We say, well, that's the Old Testament, right? What about the New Testament God? There's more in the New Testament. A couple of them here. 2 Corinthians 7:1. "Let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." Not the love of God, in the fear of God. "And work out your own salvation with" what? "Fear and trembling." Trembling. What about the early church? Did they fear God? Take a look at the book of Acts. In Acts 5, after God dealt with Ananias and Sapphira, we read, "Great fear came upon them all and upon the whole church." And we read of that fear of God in Acts 9:31, 10:2, 10:22, 10:35, 13:16, 13:26, 16:29, and again in 19:17, concluding in the church of Ephesus, we read, "And the fear fell upon them all, in the name of the Lord Jesus was extolled." The fear fell upon them all. When was the last time the fear of God fell upon you? Even Jesus tells us to fear God. Jesus said, "Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him, God, who can destroy both soul and body in hell." Fear him. Jesus says, fear him. Fear him. He distinguishes. Now, I want to be careful here, because Jesus also distinguishes this fear of God from every other fear that we could possibly have. All right? He says, don't fear those other fears. Fear this fear. You know, we have a lot of things we can fear. You know, a teacher handing out grades. That can be a fearful experience. I remember that from college. Our boss asking for a meeting that we're not expecting. That can create and generate some level of fear. A doctor with results of some biopsy or blood test or scan. Getting the phone call, that can cause some fear. A police officer, when the lights light up behind you, instant fear. I know that one a few times. There's other things. I mean, I think some people are afraid of other people, like what people think about them, how they're perceived. They live in that fear of others. They maybe not even consciously, but subconsciously, what others think about them and how they view them. Jesus says, don't fear those fears. Charles Spurgeon puts it this way. I got this from the commission retreat. The fear of the Lord is the death of every other fear. Like a mighty lion, it chases all other fears before it. The fear of the Lord is the death of every other fear. Maybe you're a fearful person, so you don't like to hear this idea of fearing God. I want to encourage you that the fear of God is the one healthy fear you can actually have, and it'll chase those other fears away. This may sound, you can rest in the fear of God. And we'll see that later as we go through this. The fear of God is a good thing. But some may rightly argue, and I agree with them, the greatest commandment in the Bible is to love. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself, right? We know that, right? And the Apostle John tells us that perfect love casts out fear, right? And so I'm telling you, I'd be a fool to say those verses don't exist in the Bible. And I don't want to be ignorant up here and say that love isn't important. I'm not arguing that. I'm not arguing that love isn't important. I don't think we have a problem knowing that we're loved and that we are to love. I think our problem as a modern church today is that we've lost the fear of God. You know, perfect love casts out fear, absolutely. But let me ask you, how perfect is your love? Wagering that there's only one person who ever had a perfect love. Let's consider a few men in the Old Testament who had a great, great love that would put most of ours to shame. Let's look at King David first. We know the story. But he explicitly declares in Psalm 116:1 that I love the Lord. And we have a whole plethora of psalms, poems of love written expressing his great love for the Lord. In fact, he's described, the only one I believe, is described as a man after God's own heart. You talk about an emissary of love. David is the man. But did David's love keep him in the hour of temptation? From pursuing his lusts, from committing adultery, from murder. Then we consider another great man of love. The first thing we read of King Solomon, David's son, is that he loved the Lord. He gets on the throne, does some business, and then it says of Solomon that Solomon loved the Lord, loved the Lord. And we read many passages like that of him. In fact, he went on to write the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, which is 8 chapters all about love. Like, he's the only guy in the Bible who got to write a whole book that focuses just on love. Now, people debate whether that love is between two lovers in a marriage or whether that represents God and his people. It could be both. I'm not here to argue what love he's talking about, but it didn't help him in either case. All right? Because what we find out is that he ended up with 700 wives and 300 concubines. So it didn't exactly help the fidelity of his marriage to his first wife. All right? And then we read that it didn't guard his relationship with the Lord, because we read his wives turned his heart after other gods, and that Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord. He reflects on all this. He writes one of my favorite books, Ecclesiastes. He reflects on all this in his old age. You get to the 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes. He's an old man at this point. And he writes back. He's talking about everything he's done. Vanity of vanities. All his vanities. The chasing after the wind. It's smoke. All the pleasures. All the things I pursued. All the knowledge. All the things I had. Marriages. Everything. He gets to the end of it. And he says, this is the sum of it all, guys. This is my life lesson to everybody on earth. These are my last words. Fear God and obey his commandments. That is the sole duty of man. That's King Solomon, the guy who wrote the entire book on love. I'm not arguing that we should fear God rather than love God. I'm arguing that our love for God, and in it we should fear God as well. I'm arguing that we should, yeah, absolutely love God. Who doesn't want to be a man, a woman after God's own heart? But there are times when we need the fear of God to keep us from evil, from great wickedness. You know, we don't need the church to tell us about the message of love today. I mean, we do, but you just need to watch a Coca-Cola commercial at Christmas. Or what is it, he gets us commercials during football games. And that's great. I'm encouraged by him. I love that. Or, a Shields commercial. They're always, pointing in that. You know, there's certain businesses that are out there. Love is promoted. We don't have a problem with love being promoted in our culture today. What the church is needed for is to teach the fear of God, because that is missing wholly and entirely. If you want more on this, I happened to read a book this summer, The Fear of God by John Bunyan. He wrote The Pilgrim's Progress. This he wrote a year after he finished The Pilgrim's Progress. This is a guy who, a Puritan writer as well, spent his life, started as a minister, renowned minister, powers changed, told he couldn't preach anymore, and he didn't stop, he refused to stop preaching. So they put him in prison for 12 years, where he wrote The Pilgrim's Progress. And then he got out and still was too radical, so they put him in jail for another 6 months. He wrote this after those jail sentences, The Fear of God. You know, his fear of God was greater than his fear of somebody telling him he couldn't preach, his fear of jail time. So The Fear of God by John Bunyan. I knew I needed to read this book, and apparently I didn't know I already owned it. So now I have two copies. So that's why I brought it with me. If somebody is so inclined and wants to read Old English and enjoy themselves reading The Fear of God, I've got an extra copy with me. You can see me after the service. But The Fear of God by John Bunyan. In it, he talks about the object of our fear, the rule and director of our fear. He talks about the different sorts of fear, like I just talked about, the fear of God from every other fear. In it, he talks about the grace of fear. The privileges, like the things that flow out of this, the good things that flow out of having this fear of God. The privileges of fear. And the practice of godly fear. So if you're so interested, it's not an easy read, but it's a read. What did Joseph do in light of this fear of God? We read that he did not heed her to lie with her or be with her. He did not heed her to lie with her or be with her. What we don't read here is him saying, hey, let's get together. Let's talk about your marriage issues with your husband. Maybe we can figure out what's going on there. I can help you out, get you to love your husband a little better and fix your marriage. Some counseling. Maybe once a month would be good to meet. you know, go get some coffee together. We don't read that here. He didn't even heed her to be with her. He didn't invite her back to his room to have a Bible study. If you're in college, that's a trap. I'm warning you right now. He didn't invite her back to his room to have a Bible study. Okay? I don't care how pure you think the motivations are. What about us? What do we do when this invitation to sin comes to us? How do we handle it? It's going to come. Satan prowls around like a roaring lion. It's going to come. If it hasn't already, it will. It'll knock at your door. Maybe daily, relentlessly. Romans tells us, make no provision for the flesh. Make no provision. Don't even look a second time, gentlemen. It's like, you can't help the first look. I understand that. You know, it's cooler, so it's not a big deal. But you can't help the first look. It's like, okay, she ain't wearing a lot of clothes. Do I need to really look back and see how much clothes she's wearing? You know, it's like, you don't need to do that, gentlemen and women. In this story, it's the woman who's casting the longing eyes. What is that? That's called flirting. Flirt. So I know men have a problem with looking. Women have a problem with flirting sometimes. You don't need to indulge that desire to be liked. And sometimes that's all it is. I just want to be liked, so I'm going to flirt a little bit. Make no provision. No provision for the flesh. Cut it off at its head. Don't start it. Don't go down that road. What did Joseph do when the longing eyes and these seductive words turned into physical touch and she actually grabbed hold of his clothes? He left. He fled. He ran. He went outside. And frankly, sometimes that's what you need to do, guys. It's like, man, it's getting hot in here. I need to go out there. I need to go out in public. I need to get out. I need to get out and get some fresh air. Get me out of here. It's time for a walk. Cool off a bit. That's what he does. He didn't stick around hoping it'd work out. It's work its way. You know, everything will work out. He didn't let go and let God. Let's see what God does with this. He moved. He got his butt up and ran, and apparently it caused his clothes to fall off. I don't know how that happened here. We'll see the replay. Maybe we won't. It might not be good, but anyway. So she's got his clothes in her hands. He didn't stick around. You know, the reality in this situation, we see in Pastor Ben will cover this in the next message probably, maybe. But we see what you know, there's actual capital punishment with Egypt. Beheading is what it looks like coming up. You imagine, this is captain of the guard of Pharaoh's army and his wife. What do you think would have happened to Joseph had he indulged this sin? They talk about lifting the head. I don't know what that happens, but cutting or lifting, neither one sounds good. They wouldn't have been good for Joseph. And so a lot of times we, you know, we're like, well, God will forgive me. Yeah, he'll forgive you. You still might die, but he'll forgive you. The scars are still there, but he'll forgive you. Your future calling may be completely obliterated, but he'll forgive you. You might, figurative, maybe your head won't be beheaded, but your marriage might be. Your relationship with your kids might be. The very presence, active presence of God in your life might be beheaded. I'm not saying God can't forgive, and he will, and he can restore. And we see that in David's life. We see that in the Bible. But you got to understand, if you read David's life, you should read all the stories before his sin with Bathsheba, and then read all the stories after his sin with Bathsheba. They don't look the same. He's got two kids that go off the rails, one that commits incest, murder, infighting. Even in his deathbed, two of his sons are going at it, Solomon and another son, and there's this big drama going on, and both are anointed king at the same time, and then the one ends up getting killed. Death and sorrow follow his sin, the man after God's own heart. Are we at all afraid of that consequence of God upon our lives? Yeah, he'll forgive. Doesn't mean he's going to restore everything you had before. I know a guy that lived in the house with me, a friend of mine. Actually, I counted him as a friend. Believer, was in the school ministry here. He was 18, I believe, and the girl was 16, and it was consensual. But the parents didn't like it, and so he got sentenced and had to wear an ankle bracelet the rest of his life. A big, bulky ankle bracelet. And he lived in the basement where Ben and Sash live now at the street-level house, and the signal's not real good down there. So every once in a while, it'd cut out. He'd lose signal, and the sirens would be coming through Menominee, and the cop cars would line up in front of the street-level house. Just because of his lost signal. Talk about embarrassing. I took him to the Philippines once, and we had to, in the airport on the way there and the airport on the way back, like officials had to come and do the ankle bracelet thing and do all this sort of stuff. And I mean, it was like this big deal. If he went anywhere, it was a big deal. And I'm assuming that was the rest of his life. I don't think there was any end to that, at least at that time. 18, 16, consensual. See, we don't think that there's going to be consequences to our actions. We take the mercy and grace of God for granted, and we don't fear the Lord. Do we know when we need to run from a situation, to get out? We're told, flee youthful lusts and escape the corruption that's in the world through lust in the Bible. When was the last time you fled and ran and escaped? When was the last time you fled, you ran, you escaped? The Bible says God is faithful in 1 Corinthians, and he will make the way of escape. He will make a way. So if you don't think there is a way, there is. There is always a way, otherwise God's a liar. There is a way out. And if you don't take that escape, it's your fault. It's on you, 100%. You are at fault. I am at fault. It's our problem. There is a way to get out. Listen, Jesus said, if your right eye offends you, he says, here's the way out. Gouge your right eye out. If your right hand offends you, Jesus says, cut your right hand off. Cut it off. He says, better to go to heaven with one hand or one eye than burn in hell with both. Jesus says that, the God of the New Testament. You know, for some of you, it's like, I don't know. For me, it's like when I idolized my first smartphone back in 2003. You know, I think it ended up in the lake because I had to get rid of it. It was like too much. I mean, it was too much for me. I told you guys before, I knew a guy in school ministry. I'm giving you a sad story of the affairs of the school ministry and the history here, but I knew a guy who was, you know, he had to turn his printer into the office because he was printing money on it. that was funny. I'm like, that's I've never seen that one before. But he was printing money on his printer. So he had to turn his printer and he gave his printer up to the church. We got to cut things off. I've had to cut off cable and ESPN. I'm a sports nut. I've had to, at times, give Faye my password for Amazon because I'm buying too much stuff I don't need. I mean, what do you got to do to just shut off the faucet, turn it off, get it done with? I mean, are you going to take the step? It might hurt, right? But it would have been a lot worse had Joseph not ran. A lot worse. Joseph ran for his life both physically and spiritually. Do we know when we need to run, to flee, to escape? Now, I spent a lot of time on that section. I have hardly anything on the rest. So just bear with me. We're getting close to the end. Consider the cost, the third part. It says, and so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me, to lie with me. And I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened, as I lifted my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled outside. So it was, when his master heard these words, which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this matter, that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. Now, side note on this, had his master really believed this story, he probably would have beheaded him. The reality is his master probably knew his wife wasn't as faithful as he'd like her to be. All right? So, in the prison where the king's prisoners were confined, it could have been worse, that's all I'm saying. All right? This is Pharaoh's prison. But here's a few things. There's a cost here. Did running improve or better Joseph's current situation? Now, I realize the future situation could have been beheaded. But did running help him in the immediate? No. I mean, he was over everything in his master's house. And running did not help that position at all. So when we're faced with temptation, we need to realize that it might actually cost us something gravely. Okay? Doing the right thing in the fear of God can be costly. It can sever relationships. It can cost us money, material things. It could end your job. It could make you look really stupid. Like, what a moron from the world's perspective. But ask yourself, is there anything in your life you need to flee? And in doing so, you know it'll have a real world cost. It's an important question to ask yourself this morning. Is there anything I need to run from? And I know full well if I do, there's a price to pay, a tag on that. Just consider where this story goes. And that's where we're going to, in closing, I want to look at these last few verses and cover them with you. It says, fourth, consider God's presence. Because that's a big aspect that we've neglected since the beginning of this story. Let's look at it. Verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Sound familiar? We read in verse 21, the Lord was with Joseph. And again in 23, the Lord was with him. And so we end right where we began. Joseph is in chains, but the Lord is with him. Down, up, down, up. The Lord is with him. Didn't matter what he was going through. He had the presence of the Lord. In our darkest hour, we often ask, where is God in all of this? Right? Where are you, God? I remember punching the steering wheel in my car. Where are you, God? We do that when things are rough. But for those who fear the Lord, He's right there. The Lord is with them. If you fear the Lord is with you in that darkest hour. We talked about John Bunyan. I encourage you to look at the stories of Richard and Sabrina Wormbrand, Corrie Ten Boom. The list goes on and on and on. The Lord was with them. And with this fear comes God's promises. And I could go on and on with these. I just want to give you a couple because we're running out of time. It says, He will bless those who fear the Lord, both small and great. He will bless those who fear the Lord. And that's what we see in Joseph's life. Everything he touched was blessed, no matter how dark the situation. It says, Oh, fear the Lord, you His saints. For those who fear Him have no lack. Those who fear Him have no lack. You aren't missing anything you need from God. God Himself declares to us in Malachi 4:2, To you who fear My name, the Son of Righteousness shall arise with healing in His wings. And it goes on to talk about skipping like calves and stuff. I mean, that doesn't sound too bad. This is why I said you can actually rest in the fear of God. You can find comfort and joy in the fear of God. God's promising it, and you need to receive it, that the fear of God is a great and glorious thing. Most of us know where the story of Joseph will go from here. It's not the question. The question is our story. Right? Where's your story going to go from here? Will we walk in the fear of the Lord? Will we walk in the fear of the Lord? And will the Lord's presence be with us? That's the question for today. Let's pray.